The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. And I'd like to start today's show by pointing out an important anniversary we're passing. In this case, one in world news. In December 2013, China first began creating artificial islands in the South China Sea. So that's 5 years ago this month. So December 2013. My arithmetic would be really bad if it was actually in 2003. December 2013, so it's Tianjin dredge began to take sediment from the seafloor and began dumping it on a reef until that reef became an island. It took just 4 months to create 27 acres of new land. That's roughly 14 football pitches. This area that includes a harbour. So a pretty substantial island there made in just 4 months. And this work that's been going on for the last 5 years in the South China Sea is a big deal. So it's worth pausing and considering the impact that it has had on the world. And here's what Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry had to say about it in a 2016 Key of David show.
The South China Sea is just a massive body of water where there's just all kinds of commerce that flows through there, and it's going to dramatically affect world trade around the world, and in the U.S. especially. So it is something we ought to be concerned about, because China is just simply making those nations around them submit to their will, and anybody in the world can see that. They're forcing these countries to do what they want, and everything is headed in the direction of war. And I mean real war. China's military is being strengthened all the time, as America's is being diminished. And not, actually, we keep cutting back in our military.
So this is a critical story, as Mr. Flurry said there. It's making the world more dangerous. It's pointing the world in the direction of war. And we'll talk about why in just a little bit. But this really is a critical, well, I have in my notes, a critical area of land, a critical area of sea, I should say. There's a huge amount of trade that passes through this area. One third of all maritime trade passes through the South China Sea, where China's claiming and building all of these islands. So this really is, China really is pushing them, putting themselves in a position where they can dominate the world's economy and have a huge amount of power. Here's another clip from Mr. Flurry talking about what's happening here. This time, this is from the year before, 2050.
If you look, for example, at China today, there's a lot of tension now between China and the U.S., and China is going out and making a series of man-made islands 800 miles from their shore in the South China Sea. And of course, that land belongs to others as well as to them. They're out in international waters, but they are just building military bases there. And one third of the world's commerce flows right through that area, that South China Sea. One third of the world's commerce, and the U.S. has dominated that area since World War II. And now China's challenging them openly before the world, saying, we're going to dominate this area from now on. And nobody's stopping them. Nobody's even really talking about it that much, as if, well, it didn't really exist. But look, that isn't their territory. They're pushing their neighbors around and taking parts of their territory. And where is this going to lead? They have all this power.
So they're pushing their neighbours around, they're taking that territory, and as Mr. Flurry talked about, well, nobody's standing up to them. Nobody's stopping them. Well, that was 2015, though. That was just 2 years after China got started. We're a lot further along now. It's obviously it's 2018. So 5 years further on, well, what's the situation? Has America stood up for those islands, for the claims of the other nations around China, for just the freedom of being able to have to keep this vital sea lane out of the control of an authoritarian regime? Has anyone done anything to try and stop China, to try and push back at China? Well, the Australian Strategic Policy Institute's The Strategist produced an article for this five-year anniversary of the start of these island claims. And they addressed this. What are the other nations doing about this? What's the situation 5 years on? They write, it has been just 5 years since China initiated its major land reclamation in the South China Sea, and the country has already shifted the territorial status quo in its favor without facing any international pushback. Nobody's doing anything. Nobody's standing up for them. The anniversary of the start of its island building underscores the transformed geopolitics in a corridor central to the international maritime order. So they've transformed, really, world politics, global geopolitics. And nobody's done anything about it. The article went back and talked about China's first island, the one that they built in 2013, and then continued, since then, China's built six more artificial islands in the South China Sea and steadily expanded its military assets in this highly strategic area, through which one-third of global maritime trade passes. It has constructed port facilities, military buildings, radar and sensor installations, hardened shelters for missiles, vast logistical warehouses for fuel, water and ammunition, and even airstrips and aircraft hangars on the man-made islands. Reinforcing its position further, China has strong-armed its neighbors into suspending the exploitation of natural resources within their own exclusive economic zones. Consequently, they write, China has turned its contrived historical claims to the South China Sea into reality and gained strategic depth despite a 2016 ruling by an international arbitral tribunal invalidating those claims. China's leaders seem intent on proving the old adage that possession is nine-tenths of the law, and the world, it seems, is letting them get away with it. So in 2016, there was this international court that said, no, China, you don't own those islands. That's not your territory. You can't go building artificial islands there and militarizing it and moving in and putting military bases there. And China just said, well, we don't care. We're going to keep going. And nobody did anything. The rest of the world just let that happen. How did they get away with this? Well, the article goes on to talk about some of this and the careful preparations China made, even before December 2013, when they dredged up that first island. They began testing the US with small steps, seeing how America would respond. You know, so if America responded forcefully, with these small steps, they would stop. They would know, okay, we can't get away with that. America's going to push back against us. We don't at the moment have the power to oppose that. We'll stop here. So they went in very slowly with these small steps, testing the waters. So first of all, they seized the Scarborough Shoal in 2012 from the Philippines. And so they waited to see what America would do. America did nothing. So then they published plans for man-made islands in the South China Sea and had them circulated on some Chinese news sites. Okay, well, we'll float the idea, we'll get the idea out there, we'll see how America responds. If they respond with outrage, well, then maybe we need to back down a bit. No response from America. So then China sent a destroyer to one of the reefs that it claimed, but it was also claimed by other nations. So one of these contested reefs, and it parked the destroyer there for 3 weeks. No response. And so then they figured, well, America's not going to stop us. We've tested it. We've carried out all of these tests. We'll just go ahead and claim this area and cover it with our military installations. The article continues, as China has continued to build and militarize the island, it has taken a calibrated approach, gradually ramping up its activities while keeping an eye on the U.S. reaction. The final 2 years of the Obama presidency were marked by frenzied construction. So by that time, they realized America, at least under this president, is not going to do anything. Let's build as fast and as quickly and as much as we can. And now China's there. It's in the area. It's got all of those hardened bases and massive warehouses and anti-aircraft missiles and all of these things that's going to make it much, much harder now to put China back. It would have been pretty easy to confront China back in 2012 when it was just taking those initial tests. Now, well, it's hard to see anything short of full-scale war that it would take to push them out of that area. I mean, maybe a very heightened trade sanctions regime, kind of like Donald Trump is pursuing, but with even more, and maybe he'll go down that route. But now that they've dug in, it's a problem that would have been easily dealt with in 2012, and very, very hard to deal with now. The article goes on to write, from its newly built perches in the South China Sea, China is better positioned not only to sustain air and sea patrols in the region, but also to advance its strategy of projecting power across the Indian Ocean and the Western Pacific. How can there be any hope of a free and open Indo-Pacific when the critical corridor linking the Indian and Pacific Oceans is increasingly dominated by the world's largest autocracy? And that's a good point. They've gained a lot of power here. Jeremiah Jacques had a great article in the last summer, so summer 2017's Trumpet, called "Congratulations, Beijing, the South China Sea is now yours." And it's pretty much job done at this point. Now, there's some points here that I want to pick up on in the second half of the show. But before we get there, I want to bring your attention to another article that caught my eye. This was from Bloomberg yesterday. U.S. China, get used to it, America. We're no longer number one. So America's no longer number one and needs to get used to it. This article states, in other words, the economies of China and the U.S. are fairly evenly matched in size, but with four times the U.S. population, China has much more room to grow, and China is already the world's largest manufacturer and biggest exporter. In other words, so it went through all of these different stats in that article to get to that point, and then says, in other words, if it's not already the world's dominant economic power, China soon will be. But what does this mean? What are the implications of China's economic dominance for the world and U.S. policy? So China's the world's top economy now, basically. And if it's maybe not quite over that line exactly yet, everything's pushing in that direction. The article goes through some of the different ways that China is number one and some of the ramifications for this, about manufacturing just getting faster and faster in moving over to China as they're trying to reach out to all of those billion or so Chinese consumers, sell to them, use them as their workforce. Talks about more instability in the dollar as more and more people start using Chinese currency. Talks about U.S. allies as, there's no longer an overwhelming financial advantage in being allied to the U.S. because China is now this massive financial power moving away from the United States. And it concludes, so the fact that China is now or will soon be the world's biggest economy matters a lot. It means the U.S. can no longer depend as much on its large markets to secure investment or geopolitical fealty. Unless China makes severe missteps in the near future, like barring foreign companies, crushing productivity with excessive government control, or precipitating domestic conflict, it will enjoy many of the benefits that once flowed to its chief rival. So China's one of the big up-and-coming powers in the world, and they're getting control of this South China Sea. So what does this mean for the world? What does this mean for you? Because it's easy to think of this as maybe, oh, this is an issue for East Asia. This is an issue if you're the Philippines or Vietnam and you've got China claiming parts of your island or islands that your country also claims. Vietnam's not an island, obviously. But this doesn't. This is not just a story for them. This is a story that will affect everyone. And Mr. Flory powerfully drew attention to that when he wrote an article on this subject back in 2016 titled, China is Steering the World Towards War. And in that article, he talked about some of those islands that we've already talked about, and he covered some important history. He wrote, what is happening today is very much like what happened in Southeast Asia in the 1940s under Imperial Japan. And he talked about the Greater East Asian Co-Prosperity Sphere that was Japan's aim to gain hegemony over the region. He writes that between 1930 and 1941, Japan established a shadow empire of economic alliances and intelligence networks across Southeast Asia. This shadow empire was to be the foundation of the planned Greater East Asian Co-Prosperity Sphere. Japan's next move was the establishment of an actual Asian empire using military force. Once World War II started, the Japanese Empire claimed the entire South China Sea and built military bases in some of the very same archipelagos China is militarizing today. A Japanese submarine base on the Isle of Ituaba in the Spratly Islands served as a staging base for Japan's invasions of the Philippines, the Dutch East Indies, now Indonesia, and Malaya, now part of Malaysia. This base was instrumental in Japan's strategy to cut off Allied shipping in the region. So they wanted to gain control of shipping, and they tried to get control of exactly the same area China's getting control of today. Mr. Flory goes on to write, the Allied victory over Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan in World War II was greatly aided by the fact that, that the US and Britain controlled the world's most strategic sea gates like Panama, Gibraltar, and Singapore. In the decades since, however, China and the European Union have come to possess most of the world's sea gates. Time will prove that this is a deadly, dangerous change. And that article went on to talk about some of those changes. It talked about how the UK once had a major naval base at Singapore, and this fell to Japan during the war. And that really was seen as the beginning of the end of the British Empire. Singapore had been built up to be, as Churchill called it, the Gibraltar of the East. It was meant to be this big naval presence and naval base. Now, though, China's moving in on Singapore and gaining a lot of influence there. Britain used to have Hong Kong. It gave that up to China in 1997, and now China's really moving far beyond that and claiming the whole of the South China Sea. Going back to that article, Mr. Flory wrote, by building artificial islands atop coral reefs in the Spratlys and installing surface-to-air missile batteries in the Paracels, China is building a new strategic sea gate. After passing through the Strait of Malacca, oil tankers and other ships pass between the Spratly and Paracel Islands on their way through the South China Sea. So China's getting control of these gates and then even building new gates. And Mr. Flory in that article covered specific prophecies where God showed that this kind of thing would happen. He quotes Deuteronomy 28 and verse 52, which says, and he shall besiege you, talking about your enemy, he shall besiege you in all your gates, until your high fence walls come down wherein you trusted, throughout all your land. And he shall besiege you in all your gates, throughout all your land which the Lord God has given you. And Mr. Flory showed in his book, or Mr. Armstrong showed in his book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, that these warnings in Deuteronomy 28 are warnings for our nations today. He also quoted from Ezekiel chapter 4, which is a prophecy there, talking about how Israel will be laid siege against. He basically tells Ezekiel in vision, and lay siege against Jerusalem, build a fort against it, cast a mound against it, set the camp also against it, and set battering rams against it round about. Moreover, take you unto you an iron pan, and set it for a wall of iron between you and the city, and set your face against it, and it shall be besieged, and you shall lay siege against it. This shall be a sign to the house of Israel. Now, in the book of Ezekiel, when he wrote that book, Israel was long gone into captivity already. Why would they need a warning about being besieged if Israel was in captivity already? Ezekiel himself was in captivity in Babylon, but then the northern tribes of Israel went into captivity 100 years more before Why do they need a warning about a siege? Well, it's because it's for today. It's a warning for modern Israel. And Mr. Flory wrote, here is a picture of a siege against the house of Israel. It is prophecy that one third of these nations will be destroyed economically and socially by a siege. Now, the Bible has a lot to say about these sea gates in America and Britain being besieged by them. In Genesis 22, and verse 16 to 18, God promised the descendants of Abraham that they would possess the gate of his enemies. Then Rebekah, Abraham's daughter-in-law, was told again, let your seed possess the gate of them, of those which hate them. The full quote there actually is, be you the mother of thousands of millions, and let your seed possess the gate of them which hate them. In the context of thousands of millions of people, what is the Bible talking about when it talks about gates? I mean, obviously, it's not a literal gate in a wall when you're talking in terms of hundreds of millions of people. What is the kind of thing what's the closest that international relations has to a gate? What gates are there that affect millions of people? Well, it has to be talking about these great sea gates, these great maritime choke points. So in the book of Genesis, God told the descendants of Abraham, modern Britain and America, you're going to possess the gates of your enemies. You're going to possess these sea gates that gives you huge military advantage all around the world. And then in Deuteronomy 28, God says, well, if you don't obey me, then your enemies are going to get control of those gates. And they're going to use them against you, to besiege you, to cut you off economically. These are remarkable fulfilled prophecies. I mean, why even talk about gates in kind of ancient times, thousands of years ago, when these books were written? How could gates of your enemies seem like a big deal 2,000 years ago? Well, much more than 2,000 years ago for these books, 4,000 years ago. Or maybe I'm going back too far then, 3,000 or somewhere in the middle. But now these sea gates are huge. And 90% of the world's trade travels by ocean. In the UK, 95% of the products we use comes from overseas. That's according to the Maritime Foundation. That's huge. Probably most of the products you own, or right in front of you right now, even if they were made in your country, would made using raw materials or equipment that came from overseas. Whatever you're listening to be on was probably made in China. And if it wasn't, then the chips and the things inside probably were. And they would have come to you through a sea gate. I had a very quick look at my clothing labels before the show. I think all I could find was my tie and my shoes. But my tie was made in China. And would have come again, presumably by sea, through several of these sea gates. My shoes made in Italy. Most likely coming overseas then, through the Straits of Gibraltar. The book I have with me at the moment, that was printed in the United States. So that would have come from overseas. Here in the UK, most of our food and our oil, you know, the big necessities of modern life, come from overseas. You can look, actually, maritimetraffic.com. It's a fascinating website where it just shows you live the location of ships at sea. And you can see how they really are concentrated really closely just around these sea gates. And God said thousands of years ago, he told Britain and America, you will have the gates of your rivals. And then sure enough, Britain had these sea gates, like Gibraltar, like Hong Kong, like Singapore. America had the Panama Canal. And they proved a huge advantage. And then God said, well, if you don't obey me, your enemies will use those gates to besiege you. And now, who do we see? Well, we see these two nations losing those sea gates. I mean, it would almost be inexplicable were it not for these prophecies. How do you have so much power from these gates and then just lose them? But that's what we've been doing. And now we see these up-and-coming major rivals like China getting control of these sea gates. And the Bible says, well, they're going to use them not just to secure that particular area, not just against, say, maybe the Philippines or against Taiwan. They're going to use them to wage economic war around the world. They control now a third of maritime commerce. And then you look at all the other sea gates they're getting involved in. Herbert W. Armstrong talks about this in his book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. And if you've not read that book, I'd really urge you to get it. And that book is about the identity of those two nations, the United States and Britain. And towards the beginning of that book, Mr. Armstrong writes, "This very eye-opening, astounding identity is the strongest proof of the inspiration and the authority of the Holy Bible. It is at the same time the strongest proof of the very active existence of the living God." And the United States and Britain in Prophecy makes the Bible come alive as a now book, as a book that describes history, as a book that describes current events, as a book that describes what's been happening in the last 5 years in the South China Sea, why Britain and America gave up these sea gates, and much, much more beside that. I mean, it shows that the Bible is a book for our lives now that has relevance to today's world and can really make the Bible come alive. So that's that book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, where you can go and read more about sea gates and a whole lot more. That book and all of the rest of our literature, that's available on our website, thetrumpet.com. You can just go and click on the literature tab at the top right of that screen. You can read the book online or download it for any number of devices. But more importantly, you can order your own print copy of that book so you can go through that for free with no shipping costs, anything like that, absolutely free. We don't pass your details on to anybody. We just use it to send you that book. So you can order that on our website, and we'd be very happy to send that to you, to ship it. I think we ship just about anywhere in the world. So please do go online if you've not read that book and order it at thetrumpet.com, and it will really help the Bible and world events come alive for you. Well, we'll take a quick break, and when we get back, we will get into a slightly different but still related subject on world news.
You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. America's status as the world's lone superpower is rapidly fading. Other nations and groups of nations are angling to fill the void. Rising in the East is an emerging power block of tremendous potential in manpower, economic heft, and military might. Its growing presence is intensifying global competition for resources and for geopolitical influence. Where will this trend lead? What does this mean for you? Biblical prophecy provides a remarkable, penetrating preview of Asia's future. Request a free copy of Russia and China in Prophecy. This book exposes in startling detail what Russia and China are doing and will do, and how they will affect your life. Also, you'll be sent a free one-year subscription to The Trumpet magazine. The Trumpet looks at today's headlines through the clear light of Bible prophecy. The Trumpet will keep you up to date on the continuing rise of the powers in the East by taking a hard look at today's news and comparing it to the prophecies of the Bible. The Trumpet magazine is this world's most informed news magazine. To learn more, request a free copy of Russia and China in Prophecy. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. Act today and request Russia and China in Prophecy. This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
Hello, and welcome back to The Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. And I'd like to start out now continue with a couple of stories that don't sound at first sight connected to what we talked about in the first half, but really are. This first one, it comes from War on the Rocks on December 10th. It's titled, "The Historical Profession is Committing Slow Motion Suicide." It begins by talking about a recent study showing that the number of students majoring in history has fallen by 30%, and that history now accounts for a smaller share of all U.S. bachelor degrees than at any time since 1950. This article states that although all humanity disciplines have suffered declining enrollment since 2008, none has fallen as far as history. Yet a deeper dive into the statistics revealed that history's fortunes have worsened not over a period of years, but over decades. And it goes back and showed how far they've fallen from the late 1960s. And they write, "This fact underscores the sad truth of history's predicament. The discipline mostly has itself to blame for its current woes. In recent decades, the academic historical profession has become steadily less accessible to students and the general public, and steadily less relevant to addressing critical matters of policy, diplomacy, and war and peace. It's not surprising that students are fleeing history, for the historical discipline has long been fleeing its twin responsibilities to interact with the outside world and engage some of the most fundamental issues confronting the United States." And it goes on to talk about this. He says it says there was a time when academic historians actively engaged in shaping policy on the critical issues of the day, and when the top academic historians wrote for a larger public audience. And it gives some examples, and you don't have this anymore. And to me, this part of the article gets to the most concerning aspect of this story. I mean, you can learn a lot of history without necessarily going to university and getting a history degree. If throughout the general public and even in government, if people still had a strong, solid background in history, I wouldn't be hugely concerned that fewer people are majoring in history. But that's not what's happening. Our whole society, from leaders to individuals, are becoming less and less informed by history. And this article focuses on the responsibility of the historical profession in that. You know, part of the reason that's happening is historical, you know, academic historians, they're not trying to reach out to the general public. They're not trying to reach out to politicians. They're not trying to look at world events through a lens of history and help others do that. This article writes, "Yet as the historical discipline, like much of the American academy, becomes more professionalized, especially after World War II, it also became more specialized and inward-looking. Historical scholarship focused on increasingly arcane subjects. A fascination with innovative methodologies overtook an emphasis on clear, intelligible prose. Academic historians began writing largely for themselves. Popularizer, someone who writes for the wider world, became a term of derision within the profession." And it went on to talk about how history has all become very politically correct. It's all about different genders and marginalized groups, and people excluded from society and minority viewpoints. It writes, "During the 1960s and after, the discipline was therefore swept by new approaches that emphasized cultural, social, and gender history, and that paid greater attention to the experience of underrepresented and oppressed groups." So historians themselves, they're no longer looking like, well, what can we learn about war from history? What can history teach us about how to prevent war? What can history teach us about what to do about China in the South China Sea? Okay, it's 2012, they've started to poke the United States, they've started to see what they can get away with. What does history tell us about how we should respond? You know, not only are the leaders not asking that question, not only are politicians not studying or looking at history that way, not only are the people not looking at history that way or even knowing any history in that way, the historians themselves aren't looking at history that way. They're not asking, well, how can we stop an aggressive power? What mistakes have diplomats made in the past that we can learn from? Instead, it's all about, well, how has such and such an ethnic group been marginalized? This article writes, "At the time when international tensions are rising and rivalry among great powers is sharpening and the prospect of major international war no longer seems so remote, the historical discipline is devoting scant effort to generating the knowledge that might equip the United States to deal effectively with these challenges. Yet academic historians are simply not focusing their efforts on some of the issues that matter most to the fate of the United States and the international system today." Victor Davis Hanson had an article from just yesterday on this same subject. And he was commenting on an Atlantic piece, "The Liberal Arts May Not Survive the 21st Century." I didn't write down the title of his article, I'm afraid, but you know, he was talking about this decline of history too, and he was also talking about the same cause. And he writes, "In the case of history, few increasingly wish to sit in a class where the past becomes tedious melodrama rather than complex tragedy. a sort of re-education camp in which modern standards of suburban orthodoxy time travel to the past in order to judge materially impoverished historical figures or to pivotal events of either culpable or materially impoverished history of historical figures or pivotal events as either culpable or exonerated. Hard to read, hard to study too. Now history just becomes this type of gender study. Studying biographies these days is, you know, that's more and more poo-pooed. You know, that's great man history. Well, we don't do great man history anymore. That's not politically correct. It's not politically correct to believe that great individuals changed history. Because a lot of those individuals were old white men. And we don't study them. Oh, we've got nothing to learn from them. It's the masses that change history. So we don't do great man history, no biographies. That's the approach that's coming more and more in history. Victor Davis Hanson goes on to write, "The tragedy then is not just that a campus of the University of Wisconsin would drop the history major, but that the custodians of history in the 21st century lost the ability to teach and write about history in a way that sustains a hallowed 2,500-year tradition. In other words, what is being jettisoned is likely not just history as we once understood it, but rather de facto poorly taught hyphenated studies courses, which sadly become snapshots of a particular and often small eras of history designed to offer enough historical proof of preconceived theories and contemporary modern society." He writes that once a student has signed up for a class on the Renaissance or the Great Depression and quickly learns that it can become a periodic harangue on the oppression and victimization of particular marginalized groups, she will likely not wish to repeat the experience on money borrowed at between 5 and 7% interest, or to be convinced that a future employer wishes to be woke by a heady 21-year-old. So the problem today is not just that nobody studies history. It's that even those that are, the academics leading this profession study it in a way that they don't draw any lessons out of it. If you're just looking at how a one-legged transgender woman would be discriminated against in the 1930s, you're going to learn absolutely nothing from the run-up to World War II. And this lack of history at all levels, within the public, within the leadership, it's playing a major role in world events. I mean, look at what we just talked about in the first half with the South China Sea, where China kept testing the waters. Let's push America here, see what happens. Nope, no response. Okay, keep going. Let's push America harder. Nope, still no response. Well, let's try something else. Let's keep pushing. And the more we get away with, the more we'll try to get away with. The faster we'll try to get away with it. And it doesn't take much history to identify and see how you have to confront that approach. I mean, the 1930s is the most obvious example, but that's just how aggressive imperialistic nations always behave. Let's increase our power a little bit. Okay, no one really pushed back. Well, let's go for more. That's exactly how Adolf Hitler behaved, and just like what you see China doing with the South China Sea, he would have been easy to confront at the start of his rise. When he just marched some troops into the Sudetenland and was ready to turn around and march them back if anyone stood up to him. No one did. Well, okay, well, we'll take over Austria then. Nope, still no one stood up to us. Well, sorry, I said Sudetenland earlier. I meant the Rhineland. Marched into the Rhineland, Austria, no one stood up to us. Okay, well, the Sudetenland, no one stood up to us. Well, the rest of the west of Czechoslovakia, we'll take that then. Oh, nope, still no response. Now, we appeased Hitler, and we're trying to appease China right now. And we've got Bloomberg saying, well, China's number one and we've just got to get used to it. That's the way that it is now. And nobody sees a big problem with an authoritarian regime you're seeing more and more articles about them locking up thousands of their own people in these re-education camps, shutting down churches, arresting, locking up Christians because that's subversive to the state. And this nation's growing in power and nobody really sees any problem with it or any reason to stand up to them. It's a lack of a knowledge of this kind of history within the leadership and within the general public. There's no outrage from the general public trying to get the leaders to do something either. It's no coincidence that Winston Churchill, who almost alone saw through what Hitler was doing in the 1930s and was saying, well, we have to stand up for him, was himself a historian. Andrew Roberts, in his new biography of Churchill, Churchill Walking with Destiny, he writes, Churchill's living sense of history, especially his capacity to use apposite analogies from Britain's past, served him and his country well. It allowed him to appreciate that the appeasers were acting outside the traditions of British foreign policy, which for centuries had been proactive, pugnacious, and occasionally piratical in preventing any power from gaining hegemony over the European continent. So he understood what was happening there because he knew history. In my trumpet brief, I talked about the way Britain is just being humiliated by Europe over Brexit. That was the email sent out yesterday, where Theresa May, she travelled to Brussels last week to try and get a better deal because this one wouldn't get through Parliament. And she was just spurned. The Spectator, the EU leaders, they met to have a dinner without her on Thursday evening. The Spectator wrote that they decided to pull the plug on cooperation with her at this dinner and instead removed supportive phrases from the draft conclusion of the summit. So it was clear there was no longer a spirit of cooperation. Europe doesn't want a spirit of cooperation with Britain. They want Europe to tell them what to do and Britain to follow. The Spectator, they wrote, May hasn't expected to return with everything improved and signed off, but she expected to travel with Brussels, but she had travelled to Brussels believing the summit would at least provide her with evidence that EU leaders were listening to the UK Parliament. This isn't the first time May has been humiliated at such a meeting. She went and asked for help and received humiliation. But we're taking this approach of just kind of hoping they'll be nice to us, in part because of a historical blindness. You know, study history, you know Europe is going to act hard-nosed, in their own interest, playing hardball. You know, they're not this kind of warm, fuzzy community of nations put out in their PR. I mean, really nobody in this world is. So with that right focus, well, you change your whole Brexit approach right from the start, being prepared to get tough because you know, well, that's the only way you're going to get anything from these negotiations. But you know, that lack of knowledge, that history is behind the failings in this deal. It's behind the division in this country where there's so many that want to stay in Europe. They're worried about having a shortage of Mars bars, and so they want to stay in. Because having freedom and independence isn't worth it if it means we have to go without a Mars bar or two. And people who know their history, they see what's happening. Mr. Stephen Flurry on this show quoted earlier in the week from that James Pinkerton article in the American Conservative, where he wrote that the dream of a united Europe will always endure, at least in the minds of would-be Charlemagnes. Of course, such an imperium requires a fist. The more mailed, the better. And he can make that comment because he studies history. And that comment will have resonance with people because they've studied history. They know who Charlemagne is and what he does, what he did. If you don't, and that quote doesn't really even mean anything. He sees the nature of Europe because he understands that history. I mean, if you look at what Churchill was doing in the 1930s, when he was warning about what Hitler was doing in Europe, he was putting a huge amount of effort into that warning, into gathering intelligence on what was happening in Europe. But what else was he doing in that time period of the 1930s? He was writing a history book. That was one of the big things he was devoting his time to. His book, Marlborough, His Life and Times, was finished in 1938. So this critical time period, this is what he was doing, and it was a huge undertaking. This biography is pretty much the definitive book on Marlborough. And it's a work of proper, serious, even academic historical research. And it's over 1 million words long. He put real effort into writing this book. Leo Strauss, an American academic in political philosophy, he called it the greatest historical work written in our century, an inexhaustible mine of political wisdom and understanding, which should be required reading for every student of political science. This was the period of history that he even studied at this point in time far more in detail than any other. He himself said, I felt as if I was walking with destiny and that all my past life had been but a preparation for this hour and this trial. And when he said this, well, a huge chunk of his last 10 years had been devoted to this book, on this history, on this great man, the Duke of Marlborough. That was a large part of his preparations. And the parallels of, you know, what was facing Churchill and what was facing his ancestor, the Duke of Marlborough, are striking. Marlborough was fighting France under Louis, well, under the Sun King, one of the Louis. They have way too many Louis. I think I've said that before, but they do. And King Louis was on the brink of absorbing the Spanish Empire into the French Empire. He was on the brink of conquering the Holy Roman Empire, so basically, you know, taking out massive chunks of Germany and Austria. And so think of what that would have meant in 1704, when he would have ruled just about all of mainland Europe, South America, almost all of North America. If he'd have won, there would have been no British Empire, no United States of America, that would have been colonized by French and Spanish instead. He ruled by divine right. He was barely less than a god. He could do nothing wrong. There was no French parliament or any kind of equivalent. So he was on the brink of covering the known world with this kind of absolute rule. And against this, Marlborough led a coalition force of allies that he had to hold together. And it's a really fascinating read. It's like Churchill isn't just writing history, but having a conversation with it. I mean, I'll read you one quote here where, you know, he's talking about Marlborough's situation, but it certainly sounds like he's talking about his own while he's writing it as well. He writes, "It was not that Marlborough feared the task. The task was not confided. It was not that he felt unequal to it." This is really the task of saving Europe. "It's not that he felt unequal to it. Indeed, part of his trial consisted in seeing so clearly what ought to be done and was prevented. Give him a reasonably free hand to direct the war policy, even on only two of the countries of which he was captain general, even only for a year, and he felt sure he could transform the scene. But to be at once burdened, paralyzed, and abused was more than could be endured." And that's what Churchill was going through at that time. He saw the problems, he saw what to do. He had no power to fix it. And he was burdened, paralyzed, and abused by so many around him. And other passages in the book are almost prophetic, describing the role that Churchill himself would have in the future. And I don't want to read too much of the quote, but at the same time, it's such a good quote. I don't want to leave too much out. But he writes here, "The annals of the British Army contain no more heroic episode than this march from the North Sea to the Danube. The strategy which conceived, the secrecy and skill which performed, and the superb victory which crowned the enterprise have always ranked among the finest examples of the art of war. But a brighter and truer glory shines upon the man that can be won by military genius alone." And this is the bit that just, you know, really seems to describe almost what Churchill ended up doing. "Never did lifeboat captain launch forth to the rescue of a ship in distress with more selfless devotion to duty. Not Wolfe before Quebec, not Nelson before Trafalgar, nursed a purer love of his country's cause than Marlborough in this supreme passage in his career. The profound calculations which he made, both political and militarily, could only present a sum of dangers against which forethought could make no provision. All that gallant army that marched with him risked life and honour, but he alone bore the burden. It was for them to obey the lawful authorities. For him the task was to persuade, deceive, and defy them for their own salvation. Marlborough felt the greatest compulsion that can come to anyone, the responsibility of proprietorship. It had become his war. He was the hub of the wheel. He was bound to function. He had made the treaties. He had accepted William's bequest. He must discharge it faithfully. He must bring all to success and safety. The task was his. These foolish, frantic parliaments, jealous princes, hungry generals, and bitter politicians were all, as he conceived it, in his care. He alone knew the path which would lead them out of their tangles and tribulations, and he was bound to force or trick them to salvation if he could." That was Churchill describing Marlborough, but that was Churchill's role just a few years after he wrote that book in World War II. But it was this kind of study of history that enabled him to clearly see the problems around him, that prepared him for leadership. And then when Churchill was in power, he used this history to rally the nation. This is the speech that he gave on September 11th, 1940. So he's preparing the nation for a possible invasion, warning them that German soldiers could land in Britain any day now, that they need to be ready to fight back. And this is how he endeavored to stir them.
Therefore, we must regard the next week or so as a very important week for us in our history. It ranks with the days when the Spanish Armada was approaching the Channel and Drake was finishing his game of bowls, or when Nelson stood between us and Napoleon's Grand Army at Boulogne. We've read about all this in the history books. But what is happening now is on a far greater scale and of far more consequence to the life and future of the world and its civilization than these brave old days of the past. Every man and woman will therefore prepare himself to do his duty, whatever it may be, with special pride and care.
These historical speeches, wrote Roberts in his book, were all the more powerful coming from a prime minister who was also an historian and biographer. Now, Britain didn't listen to the Council of History in the 1930s, but they still had a lot of that knowledge there ready to be evoked. And Churchill was able to rally the nation like this, saying, well, we've all read our history books. We know about this history. We can be stirred by this history. And he was able to do that because, as Roberts puts it, the battles and struggles of the Elizabethan and Napoleonic Wars were then taught in schools. So the stories of Drake and Nelson were well known to his listeners. You know, they knew the story of Sir Francis Drake playing bowls as the Spanish Armada sailed towards the country to invade. Would a speech like that have the same resonance today? I mean, maybe among older generations, but not in the younger. Now, our weakness here is not just a case of politicians, but it's a public ignorance as well. In the former prophets booklet, Mr. Gerald Flowey wrote, many authorities call history our most effective teacher. And he wrote, Bible history is the greatest history of all, because it's God's history. He wrote that these books show that if we live the same lifestyles our forefathers did, we will attain virtually the same results, good or bad. History becomes prophecy. Not all prophecy is history, but a lot of history becomes prophecy. History prophesies the fate of nations, whether they will thrive or collapse. This is a law of history. So Bible prophecy is the most important history. If we want to know, you know, the really deep lessons that are really going to change our lives, we have to go back to that. Yet even with just some of the recent history, our nations would be much better placed to navigate the world that they're in. If our leaders knew history, if the people knew history, if historical professionals studied history better rather than making it a branch of gender studies. I looked over in getting ready for this Mr. Stephen Flowey's article from the summer, Why Study History? And one of the big points he emphasized that he brought out from Mr. Gerald Flowey was having a positive view of history. I don't really have time to read those quotes that he had there, but a positive view of history. And that's a point Mr. Flowey makes in the Book of Chronicles. And it's really interesting to see in Churchill's book about Marlborough. It's that same approach. It's a very positive view. It mentions Marlborough's downsides. And in my opinion, he spends way too long trying to argue with Macaulay. That's the one downside of the book. But he points to the downsides, but his whole approach is similar to the one Mr. Gerald Flowey describes, in that it emphasizes the positive. You can tell that while he writes it, you know, Churchill has a real admiration for the man he's writing about. It's not a very scholarly approach, but it makes it engaging, and it helped him draw practical lessons out of it. Andrew Roberts, in his book, he wrote that Churchill's historical imagination was powerful, but it was also practical. It was intended to instruct and inform. This was true of every history book he wrote, and part of the reason why, by his death, Churchill had sold more history books than any other historian in history. So Churchill was a historian, and that played a huge part in his greatness. And where do you see that today? Where do you see any public figures, really, who are steeped in history this way? I mean, maybe with some of those that are pro-Brexit, a lot of those that have studied history, but it's something that's rapidly diminishing from the world, and it's leading us to make these silly mistakes, like with the Brexit negotiations, like with the South China Sea. Now, for a deeper study on history, get our free book, The Former Prophets. There's a strong section on history there, and it gives great insight into Bible history as well, that you can really dig into and learn lessons that apply to the nation, but also just very practical lessons that apply to our own lives as well. Once again, just like with the book I mentioned at the start, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, you can get that at our website, thetrumpet.com. You can read it online. And again, we're very happy, more than happy, to send you that print copy for you to have a physical copy of that and read that history for yourself along with your Bible. So you can get that at, as I said, thetrumpet.com. That's about it from me today. Tune in tomorrow when Mr. Stephen Flowery will be back. Send us any comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thanks for listening.